Terry, as I introduce you, do you want the machine up here so you can push your own buttons, or do you want Robin to do it? Okay. All right. So our next topic is kind of the review process, primarily the state review process. And Mary Graney, the Water Resources Department, is going to do that for us. We are in good shape here, so it's a good way to start the morning. Mary's the hydroelectric program coordinator for the Water Resources Department. She's been working for 20 years, water rights, large mapping projects, and hydro projects. Turns out that back in the day, Mary was an Oregon Department of Energy person. And at the Department of Energy, she managed the tax credit programs for conservation and renewable resources. Before that, she worked in Washington with small-scale hydroelectric projects as part of the Washington State Energy Office. And she's got a master's in engineering and science from UW, bachelor's in engineering from Illinois, so I guess she's experienced different parts of the country. Apparently the microphone position is important. Those in the back are letting us know that, so my apologies for half of what I just said at the beginning. And then for you, Mary, I guess you need to hold it close or speak really loud. So anyway, let's welcome Mary.
So I'm here today representing the Oregon Water Resources Department, and in the back is Craig Mohanic, who works with me. Craig gives a wave, he's in the green shirt back there. And we are the two staffers, the whole staff, for hydroelectric for the department. Although there's another person that handles the dam safety issues. So. We handle the water rights processing, and the statute that controls most of what we do is titled ORS 543. This has been around since February 1931. And in that statute, it says that all water power projects for the generation of electricity need to be in conformance with the statute. So there are no exceptions to the hydroelectric requirement, although Jan Lee is going to talk later today about an expedited process that is being proposed through the legislature for people that have existing water rights and existing diversions that want to merely add on hydroelectric to the project. So she will talk about that later this afternoon, and we'll be happy to answer questions on that. So this requirement to get a permit or a certificate fits in with the broader context of the water rights laws. And the first-in-time, first-in-right priority system has been in place since February of 1909. And we do have hydroelectric projects in the state that predate that, that are part of what have to be adjudicated water rights, that get a decree through the court system. So there are several projects in the state that have old water rights. In 1931, then they set out this new process. From 1909 to 1931, you could get a water right for a power project, but most of those, essentially all of those, had a 50-year expiration date. So I'm not sure if they just expected this was a new technology and it might go away. There was an expectation that the projects would be amortized and pay for themselves, and it was a good thing, then the state would want to take over the projects and maintain them. So for a long time, it was assumed that the state was going to take over hydroelectric projects. And then all the way up until the 1980s, when we finally got new legislation that gave us a process for relicensing hydroelectric projects, and we've been through that process the last 10 years or so with a lot of the major power utilities getting their projects relicensed. So a water right can be authorized for a major or a minor project. For privately owned entities, we still have a time limit that usually matches the FERC time limit. So it can be up to 50 years for a water right. Water rights that do not expire can be issued to municipalities, irrigation districts, municipal corporations. So those folks, they have the same natural resource standards required of their projects that a private developer would have, but they get a water right permit that can grow into a water right certificate, and that is a forever type of water right, just as the other water rights folks normally get. So projects may be large or small, and when our statute talks about a minor hydroelectric project, they're talking about really small. They're talking about less than 100 theoretical horsepower. And in the state of Oregon right now, we have about 150 hydroelectric projects that are paying us annual fees for their project. And about half of those are minor projects, and half of them are greater than 100 theoretical horsepower. But the 100 theoretical horsepower, from a water perspective, some of those projects use 4 gallons a minute, and some of those projects can use up to 10,000 gallons a minute. So for us, you know, that's different pipe sizes, obviously, between 4 and 10,000. So there's a lot of different impacts. Each project has to be evaluated on its own set of circumstances, and you can imagine there's a wide range of circumstances that we see for these projects. So the statute defines the theoretical the maximum theoretical horsepower that is given a water right, and this is based on the maximum amount of water that's going to be used in cubic feet per second times the average head that is utilized on the project, and that's divided by 8.8 to convert it into theoretical horsepower. What you don't see on here is any efficiency factor. So the water right is for the maximum potential of that site. So what you reserve is the total capacity of that site for one project. And then if the project increases in efficiency, you start off with a turbine and a generator. If there's some way to increase that efficiency, it's not necessary to change the water right to reflect that. When you claim the site, you claim the total amount of potential that is there. And that affects the annual fees that you pay for the project. Okay, so I'm not sure how many people here are interested in the really minor projects. There is an application form. I've got a few in the back, on the back table, if anybody's interested. It's pretty straightforward. It can be printed off from our website. There is a guide book that is with there also that explains how to calculate the theoretical horsepower and some instructions on how to fill out the form. The interesting thing about the minor applications, when they come into our office, the Water Resources staff takes responsibility for notifying all of the state agencies, state, federal, local agencies that might be interested in this project when we do our public notice about it. So it would have to go through a typical 30-day notice period, and then after we consult with the other agencies, we usually schedule a site visit with our sister agencies, the Fish and Wildlife people and the Department of Environmental Quality, and then we put together a proposed order that explains the conditions under which the water right must operate. And typically, even under these small projects, we're going to address issues like fish screening and bypass flows, whether there needs to be fish passage or not, whether there needs to be a tail race barrier. All of these things need to be looked at. And it matters if it's a 4 gallon a minute project or if it's a 10,000 gallon a minute project. So we get a range of restrictions on the projects. So I just want to pause 1 minute and ask, are there any questions just about the really tiny minor project?
I have two related to water rights. One of them is, are these water rights specific to hydro generation, or would they be put in a reservoir? state returning the water to the stream, does that also require a permit?
Okay.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. I may go from the last question back. The last question was, if it's non-consumptive, do you still need a water right? The answer is yes. The state of Oregon requires all water uses to have their own water right. So one of the things that define a water right, the priority date, the date that you apply and that gives you a priority order against everyone else, the location, the amount of water that's used, the place of use, and the type of use. So you have to have a separate water right for irrigation and for domestic and for hydroelectric. And each one of those needs to be named somewhere in order to put the water to a beneficial use. So then the other part of the question was...
Just
answer. Okay, does that answer the whole thing?
Yeah.
That was about specificity, whether or not it was for hydro or other uses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
You mentioned on a individual use, your license will expire in 50 years. Can that be renewed?
Yes, it can.
So that's a renewal question.
Yes, so the license can be renewed, yes.
You mentioned annual fees. So I imagine there might be some variation, but can you give us a sense of magnitude, annual cost?
The original cost for a minor project, it's going to cost at least $15 a year. When it's relicensed, it gets increased to $50 a year. On the major part, the larger projects, it's about 28 cents per theoretical horsepower, and then when that is relicensed, it goes up to about 50 cents
annually. This is about the cost of the permit, the license, and then I was going to ask the same thing. I think you're asking what's the initial cost to come in.
The initial application fee on a minor project is $500 up front and $500 after it's been approved. On a major project, it's between $1,000 and $5,000 for a project up to 5 megawatts, and then it goes up $1,000 per megawatt. And that can be increased by 15% if there are endangered species, anadromous salmon or steelhead in the area. So it's $5,065.
And a question that will follow from that, but I think this is something the work group might do, is for the really small projects, if it's going to cost you $1,000 to put in something, you know, at home or on the farm, and it's not a very big system, you'll never pay for it. So either you're really dedicated to trying to harvest this resource or something. And there's a lot of discussion about, is there some other way to provide incentive to help offset that, to get small people able to participate in the system and do hydro?
On the other hand, though, we do have those smaller projects which fit in a specific niche. For people that are up in the hills away from transmission lines, it can be cheaper than putting in a transmission line. And we had a project on an existing dam where Fish and Wildlife needed to have a fish trap operated, and they already had the dam there, and all they had to do was run a little project down the side of the spillway in order to get enough power to run their fish trap. And there was another one on Coos Bay, on their reservoir, they needed to run some monitoring cameras, and so they ran a line just down along their spillway and got enough power to run the monitoring cameras for their project. So there are some innovative kind of projects out there.
If you have a fixed water right for the year, let's say 1 cubic foot per second, but you'd like to renegotiate that, say, when the flow is there, and you can actually take more, when there's less, you can actually shut it down. Is the department, they'd be willing to negotiate that?
No, that's not something that we're able to negotiate. The water right, when it specifies the quantity of water, that's set in stone with that certain priority date. If you need more water, then you need to come in again with a new application, and that is assigned the newer priority date. So you're in line behind the other people.
Well, take all my water out of the summer, which I have total right to do, would actually be possibly harmful, where in the winter when I have 100 times as much water, would be any good. So that's why I'm saying, is there a possibility to renegotiate some of this?
Is this a question about just the seasonality of the flows and
right.
and whether the right, and maybe Mary, you can talk about whether there is a variation.
We can't go over what the original water right was. There may be some opportunity if a certain amount of water has been allocated over the seasons of the year, there may be some opportunity to renegotiate that allocation over the year.
I think there was a question over there by the window.
Yes, first-in-time system applies to all of the water rights as a group. For any particular basin, they are all added together.
And Mary, so that would mean if somebody, for example, had an irrigation right, and somebody else came in and asked for the hydro right, if they were first, they'd be in line in front of the irrigation people.
Right,
or the
irrigation is reduced to take us, right, and then the hydro. Yes?
Correct me if I'm wrong. Municipalities has preference over individual or corporation?
We're going to get into that when we talk about the major projects, but that's true. The municipalities do have preference over a private developer at a particular site.
Even if the private developer applied first?
Generally, that's true, and we're going to get into the relationship between us and FERC on that decision.
So maybe we should take two more questions and then
move on to the big
projects.
The application is a $500 fee, and then $500 again when it's approved, and then $15 a year to maintain it.
Yes.
Okay. If a homeowner wants to install an off-grid power system, a battery-based system of say 600 watts, the cost could be rather discouraging to one who wants to do that for such a small amount of power. Can a water right be guaranteed for such an application?
Can you repeat that?
Can the water right be guaranteed if it's a very small project, so that as soon as you pay your $500, I guess you know that you're going to be able to get it. I guess the best advice would be if you had that kind of situation where you got very small use, it's going to be dependent on how much you like using your oil generator or whatever for power compared to using your hydroelectric. But the if you want to know if it's going to be approved or not, then you call the Fish and Wildlife Agency and you have the fish biologist come out here there and find out if there's going to be any conditions put on the use. You know, can you put in a very simple system without it? Significant costs from the screens or whatever else. If you can make Fish and Wildlife happy and the DEQ folks happy, then you can probably make the Water Resources people happy.
Is part of your question, though, are you looking at after you get the water right? Are you asking whether or not it's lost? I think I'm confused about the question.
Well, I've done very small hydro, like 1,000 watts or less. Okay, I've done a few of those. Some of my customers have found it very discouraging to find out they've got to get the water right to divert from the creek 50 or 100 gallons a minute. And they just kind of throw their hands up and go, gee, I just don't know if it's even worth bothering.
Every water use in Oregon is required to have a water right. If you don't have a water right, then our water master can come out and turn off the water.
Okay.
So you can be posted a notice saying you are not allowed to divert from this source until you get the water right.
I'll backtrack too and say that's why my point earlier about whether the state needs to look at providing incentive to those people to say, here's something to help you to offset the cost of going in and doing this the way you should do it. I mean, the flip side is it might be discouraging for me that I can't drive down the highway and throw my trash out on the street, you know, because I don't want to carry it in my car. But I mean, obviously people do that because of the cost, and that's what I was saying. At some point, maybe we can step in and provide something to offset the need to pay the fees and have to pay the fees to be able to get somebody to do the work to check and make sure things are fine. So I think last question before we go on. Does the department take a role in trying to match up people with one water use and people who want to do hydro and see if they can coordinate something to make a better package between the two different parties?
And I would say generally the answer is no, although here in the Deschutes Basin there may be more of that going on because new water available is so limited, and so people are trading credits for new water use. So the situation in this basin might be a little bit different than in the other basins. And the other thing that I wanted to add in relation to the last question was that the cost of permitting can be included when you apply for things like tax credits and other incentives. So when you look at the total cost of the project, you can build in those permitting costs to those incentive programs. Okay, so then when we talk about a major project is going to expect that the developer will consult with the agencies that have permitting authorities. And in Oregon, the most consistent agencies that have to be involved in the process are the Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Water Resources Department. And the Water Resources Department has some responsibility for coordinating with all of the agencies in order to get the final answer for is a water right to be awarded or not. The other agencies may include the Historic Preservation Office, Department of State Lands, Parks and Recreation, the Marine Board, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and the Department of Energy. And all of these may be involved more or less, depending on the actual size of the project and how much land is involved, how much water is involved. The state process is meant to mirror or parallel the FERC process. So in the state process, the first step of the federal process is to get a preliminary permit. And in the state of Oregon, we also ask for a preliminary permit. This does two things. It reserves your priority date that puts you in line with all the other water rights. It reserves your location. And the other thing is, does it reserve your preference for the project? So what happens in Oregon is that we are required on a major project, when we get an application for a preliminary permit, we publish a notice in the newspaper for 4 weeks saying that someone has proposed a project and that we're going to have a public meeting in the area talking about that project. And then we're required to wait 6 months from the time that the application is submitted to see if there's any competing applications. And it's possible that a municipality or an irrigation district or somebody would step forward and say, hey, we've got a plan to do that and we can do it just as well as the private developer. This can also happen in front of FERC. What we've seen in the past is that people tend to go to FERC first because they get a quicker answer as to who has the preference. And so FERC only waits a month or two before people to file competing applications, and they will make a decision. They have the same standard that the municipality gets the preference, but it's a shorter time frame for them to step forward. Once you have the FERC preliminary permit, then it's very difficult for anybody to challenge for the preference. So the preliminary permit does a couple of things. It saves your preference. But it is not authorization to construct, either under the FERC process or under the state process. Once you have a preliminary permit, what you can do is study the project. And so it gives you time to go out and consult with all of those agencies that we saw before, find out what their permitting requirements are, put together study plans to figure out what are the basic resource protection measures that you need for the project, how are you going to put those together in a draft application, and then to prepare a final application that is submitted for final review. Yes?
Please forgive my ignorance, maybe I didn't hear you correctly, but it sounded like you almost contradicted yourself. You said the FERC process is a 60-day filing availability for municipal preference. So, yeah, for water rights, the preliminary permit process that you have, there's a 6-month waiting period. Someone can file municipal preference within that 6 months, which takes preference or precedence. If no one files within the 60 days, the FERC process and the FERC issues the preliminary permit, the window is still open within the state agency for the water rights permit under the preliminary permit process. If someone does file a municipal preference with the water rights, does that take precedence over the FERC decision or not?
It certainly creates conflict.
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, okay. So the question is, if FERC issues a preliminary permit, and then someone files the same request for a preliminary permit with the state, the state has a 6-month opening window for someone else to jump in. So somebody jumps in late to the state process and says, we have preference under the state process for the water rate. How does that compare to what happened with FERC? And the answer is that so far we've avoided that situation. The FERC would likely have precedence. But on a water right issue, that might be something that they need to go to court for the FERC. So it would be an extended legal stress, I guess. So the private developer would have to go ahead with FERC, progressing through with FERC, but the municipality wouldn't be able to move forward with FERC. So they would have to.
Is the preliminary permit process for the water rights set by state statute?
That
or is set by regulation?
It's set by state statute. The state statute says you have to wait 6 months.
So why wouldn't there be an effort to try and parallel those two processes, the one with FERC and the state process? And is there any initiative trying to do that?
There's no initiative right now that I know of to do that, but I think it would have to be, the municipal corporations might perceive that they would have some benefit by having that extra time period to apply. So the state process tends to look more at what are the local issues, how do we take care of it on a local basis. But it would be difficult because if the municipality didn't have the preference with FERC, how could they go forward on the given state?
See, I do want to try to cut off the questions for a bit. I'd like Mary to get through. We are ahead of schedule, but let's wait and try to get to the end and then just take some time.
And later we're going to come back and let Eric talk about this because he's been through this a little bit with his project. Okay, so we've gotten through the steps you can that are followed in developing the application that FERC uses through the study process and the draft application process and then the final application. All of those, all that sets of information, all those documents can be used in the state process so that you don't have to create anything separate for the state process as much as possible. Then there are several points where the state agencies have significant input to FERC in the decision-making process. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has something called the 10J recommendations, which are the issues about fish passage, fish screening, minimum flows, that they propose to FERC as part of the environmental impact review process. The DEQ is required to issue or to consider the certification for a 401 Clean Water Act certificate. FERC needs to have that 401 certificate before they can approve the project. And then Water Resources has conditions that they apply under the water right. And so our three agencies work together to try and be sure that we're providing consistent comments to FERC on the project and to have consistent requirements among our different certificates so that we're not contradicting each other. I want to give you some examples of the types of projects that are in the pipeline right now because I work better with examples. In the last 10 or 15 years, we haven't had new projects in the pipeline. But all of a sudden, with the existing economics and stuff, we've gotten several that have come forward that are progressing along. And examples of these, the first four of these are on existing projects. As Tom mentioned before, it's much easier to go forward if you've got an existing project. So Dorena Dam is on the Coast Fork of the Willamette River at a Corps of Engineers dam. Applegate is on the Applegate River in the Rogue Basin. Fall Creek Dam is on the Middle Fork of the Willamette. And Mason Dam is a Bureau of Reclamation project in the Powder River Basin. So the interesting thing about these projects is they're all at existing dam sites. I don't believe any of them have fish passage associated with them. But each one of the proposals talks about operating the project the same way that it has been operated over the past 30 years. So the Corps of Engineers has a major scheme, you know, for balancing the water discharges from 13 different dams in the Willamette Basin. And it's expected that Dorena and Fall Creek would still be operating according to the Corps of Engineers schedules, even though we add hydroelectric as an output from the dam as the water is available. The Rock Creek project is also in the Powder River Basin. It's at a site that had an old water right pre-1909 that operated until 1990, but then the former owner surrendered the FERC license and it was decommissioned. And now the new owner wants to put in a new diversion structure, a new pipeline, replace the old flume, and use the old historic powerhouse as part of this project. So that's one that is moving forward. St. Laurent is a rancher down in the Rogue River Basin near Eagle Point Irrigation District, and the Eagle Point folks are here. Eagle Point and Pacific Power have power plants that bring water from the Big Butte Creek Basin over to an out-of-basin transfer into the Little Butte Creek, I think. And so this rancher, as part of the irrigation district, is proposing to essentially work off of the tail water from the existing power plant and make power as it goes across his property. He's also got some neighbors interested, so they're talking about several different schemes for how they're going to make use of existing diversion. The Columbia River project is a tidal project. This is one that makes all of the state agencies sit up on the end of their chairs and say, what are you proposing in the Columbia River? It's interesting, though, that there is a tidal energy project going in New York Harbor. So we're going to be learning more about this in the next few years. I don't know that we'll actually see one in the Columbia River very soon. There are seven projects that are proposed in the ocean. And all of this has happened in about the last 6 months, that people are reserving sites off of the coast of Oregon. And that's from Lincoln City all the way down to Coos Bay. And so we're going to be seeing some more on that in the next few years. The Reeds Ford project is proposing to put in a test buoy that's not connected to the grid. They want to do that this year, and they want to put in a small project in the very short time to test what the impacts of ocean wave energy are going to be. So that's going to be a new technology that we're going to see developed in the very near future. If anybody has more questions about that, we'll get back to that. So the natural resource standards for the state of Oregon set a very high bar for projects. And the standard reads that the anadromous salmon and steelhead resources shall be preserved. The Water Resources Commission cannot approve any activity that results in mortality or injury to salmon, steelhead resources, or causes loss of natural habitat for the salmon or steelhead. This is also referred to as the no dead fish rule. And they're talking about one fish. So this is what essentially halted new hydroelectric projects for many years within the state. And the exception to that is that on an existing facility or project, if the hydroelectric can be shown to restore, enhance, or improve conditions for the anadromous fish, then we can consider going forward with it. So that's why we saw that on those existing dam projects, that they have an opportunity to go forward. Another key standard that is for the resources is that there should be no net loss of wild game fish or recreational opportunities. So anytime that we're going to have an impact, we need to find ways to mitigate for those impacts, or to make things better. So if we're developing hydroelectric projects, we need to be doing it in a cooperative manner with the resources so that we get good projects both from the power perspective and from the resource standards. The other resource standards that we look at are, is it consistent with the Columbia River Basin Fish and Wildlife Program? Is the water quality going to maintain for the beneficial uses that are in the river? Are fish and wildlife habitats going to be preserved? There's likely has to be a survey for the plant resources to see if there's any rare species of plants in the area. The protection of the land resources, the land uses, the historic, cultural, archaeological. And then we also look at safety of structures and operations and the economics of the projects. So all of these things are built into environmental impact reviews for the project. And we, like I said, we use the documents that are developed for FERC for evaluating these things. Now, one of the things that Water Resources is required to do is to issue an order on the potential for the proposed project to have cumulative impacts with other existing approved or proposed projects in the basin. And this also could be a very difficult hurdle because there is a presumption that if there's more than one project in the basin, there is potential for cumulative impacts. The way to overcome that is to show that the new project that's being proposed, that the impacts on that are so small or short-term or localized that they're not likely to impact further downstream. So you really have to in order to simplify your project, you got to take care of all of the impacts in your you know, close territory so that it cannot have a further impact downstream. Then, finally, once the project has been clearly defined and we've resolved how we're going to handle the fish impacts, the wildlife impacts, the water quality impacts, then Water Resources has to take the project to a contested case hearing. And generally, if all the issues have been addressed, this should not be too difficult. If we have a potential for cumulative impacts, then we're going to have to look at all of the projects that are working together to have impacts on the river. So we hope that we've handled all of the impacts of the project before we get to the contested case hearing. So the benefits of the state project are that it allows us to manage the state's water resources consistent with the other uses of water in the basin. It provides a forum for local water users and other interest groups to participate. we coordinate the comments and recommendations from the state agencies so that we get a consistent message to the developer. And it can be accomplished in parallel with the FERC process using the application and study documents prepared for FERC. So, do we have time for any more questions?
Again, let's see.
So yeah, let's rest some more questions up here.
Okay.
Can you consult, elaborate a little bit on the what's going on with Columbia River, what that project is, concerns?
So he wants to know more about the Columbia River project.
The Columbia River project, the basic proposal is that there's, it's kind of like putting a wind turbine down underneath the water so that the turbine, the egg beater, whatever, is anchored to the bottom, and that's about as much as we know right now. So I think they're just getting a list of all of the kinds of things that they would have to study before they could do that. You know, including the impacts to the fish and the navigation and all those kind of things.
Mary mentioned the project in New York, and I think there's a reasonable amount of information on that you can find on the web if you want to see. It's a catch the tides coming and going kind of thing.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify, for a small project, did you say that your department acts as a single point of contact in working with Fish and Wildlife to be human?
For the small projects, yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. So there would be no contact between the owner and the developer and those other groups?
There could be, if
but you would
like he said, if you want to know early on, are there going to be any fish requirements? When you're doing your economic analysis of whether you should go forward with it or not, it's sometimes good to talk to the fish folks early on before you get the final application.
But in lieu of that, you handle everything with the
right.
And we do have a fish folks speaking later on about environmental mitigation, so there may be some opportunity to ask more questions about whether you go through water resources all the time or when it's beneficial to go directly to the resource agencies. We got way in the back there.
Since you mentioned the Columbia River project and the wave energy project, I just wanted to mention that similar to the DEQ 401 certification, the Oregon Coastal Management Program also has to issue a consistency assessment for the term license as well. So it's another connection.
Right, those new projects have to go through coastal zone management reserve in order to get approved. Yes?
You mentioned large major project, minimum time to get approved is 6 months. What about a minor project? What's the average or time that it takes to get one of those
approved? And he's asking about how long a small project takes to get processed at a minimum.
6 months would be a good estimate for those.
Do you want to hear a maximum? Actually, that's a serious question. How long can somebody go before they actually get an answer, whether it's a yes or a no? In your experience, how long is it running?
Well, I think we had some difficulties in the last couple of years when we were really swamped with relicensing, and we let the small guys wait too long. So we really made some effort, though, to clean out those and to process those as soon as they come in and try and get them done within 6 months.
Back over to
I've been involved in the Mason Dam project, and we're in the integrated licensing process with FERC right now, and yet we haven't, I guess, entered the preliminary permit process with the Water Resource Department yet. And I was just wondering about the time frame. The FERC licensing is very long. Should we enter the Water and Resource Department preliminary permit process immediately, or at what phase? And how the two, it surprised me that you weren't involved with the integrated licensing process since they bring all the players to the table. I think everybody was there except Oregon Water Resource.
Well, on the Mason Dam project, because it's proposed by the county is, municipalities are not required to get preliminary permits. And I think that's because they already have preference assumed. So we have suggested that that you guys go through your first year of studies coordinating with the other agencies, and then step into the water rights processing when you get the results from that first year study and you're preparing your grant application.
So we don't need a preliminary permit, but we still need a water right.
That's true.
Mary, can you kind of re-summarize that for others who might not have heard the question and how that would apply to other folks here?
The question was on the Mason Dam project, which is in the Powder River, that Water Resources has not been involved in early on in the FERC process. And that is because the municipalities are not required to get preliminary permits on their hydroelectric water use. And I think that's because they have the preference already established. So they will come to the Water Resources Department after they finish their first year of study with FERC, and they're preparing their documents and extending their project, then they will come to us and apply for a water rights permit.
Are they the only kind of entity that sort of situation would occur with?
Municipal governments, counties, irrigation districts, municipal corporations that refer to us.
So we have a question up front, or there was one
back over there.
In the process of evaluating a small hydro project, I'm told that there's an organization in the northeastern states, the United States, that helps issue guidelines regarding environmental issues such that if the project developer follows those guidelines, they more or less get what you might call a good housekeeping stamp of approval, which in turn makes it easier to gain state authorization and prevents third-party environmental lawsuits, et cetera. Can you talk about that briefly in the whole scheme of getting licensed in the state of Oregon?
That there is a hydroelectric certification, a green certification, and I think that happens mostly after the licensing process has occurred. PGE recently went through this, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about it. Which, once they've made their commitments for how they're going to address the fish impacts and what kind of screening and everything that's going to go through, then they can propose it to this group and get it certified as green power, and that helps them qualify for some other incentives. I guess.
So it sounds like you're probably talking about the Low Impact Hydro Institute, maybe?
Yeah.
I mean, there's sort of, I think, probably the, if not the only one, the leading green certifier for hydro. But your real question was, if you get that, does that streamline things with Mary's office? And it doesn't sound like that's the case, even if they could get it ahead of time.
Right. In the PGE case, they came to us and said, are you guys satisfied? Has everything been taken care of? And so I think you probably have to wait until the agencies have said this is everything that we think needs to be taken care of. And yes, it's progressing along the way that we expected it to.
And I understand that one of their criteria is that none of the permitting agencies are upset about what's going on. So it seems like it has to get through that process before they would come back and say, okay, you know, you're sanctified. Back to
you. When you're considering really small projects, the further they're flowing, how much they take out, we're all in the same boat as far as applications, but do you consider that it's not something like for adding new projects to the issue or something that's already tapped out? Is it part of the consideration process of water will be returned, or is it just assumed missing like an agricultural supply?
Well, the Water Resources always has to consider whether water is available to the system. And so, yes, we do consider whether it's non-consumptive or consumptive. We consider whether it affects other beneficial uses in the stream. Usually, because it is non-consumptive, it gives it, you know, easier path through the system.
Part B to that, if you are a rancher with existing water rights, can you amend or do you have to reapply to use the same volume but possibly throw a really small generator system on your whatever moving source you have?
Well, traditionally you would have had to reapply, but under the new law that is being considered right now and is going for hearing next week, it may be a much expedited process to add that on. So I'm going to let Jan talk about that, maybe give some examples.
Okay, we've caught up in reverse. It's now 10:30. So let's thank Mary again. So we're going to take a 15-minute break. I have a timer on my magic watch here, and so I'll start gabbering again at 15.
I just want to mention that we have asked for more coffee.
Thanks. So while we're taking our break, where is the tour sign-up document at? It's in the back? Okay, so if you haven't registered, if you haven't confirmed the tour, go back out to the registration table, put down how many people you can fit into your vehicle or how many times you're willing to ride with somebody else, and we'll start up again at 15.